Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. What you post on the photo sharing app Instagram represents a carefully curated version of your life. You can edit photos with color and brightness filters that could be more revealing than you intended, however, according to researchers who studied what those filters reveal about the state of your mental health. Joining us today is the lead author on the study from the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, Andrew Reese. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How did you design this study? What prompted it and what went into it?
There's a growing field of computational social science that tries to take techniques from statistics and computer science to look at social issues. And there's a surprising lack of psychologists involved in this field. And so I think that that's something that should be changing soon. And my goal is to kind of bring some psychological know-how into this field and maybe take a look at some of the phenomena that are happening in the world of social media that wouldn't be immediately obvious without some kind of psychological background. So that's kind of like the big picture. More specifically, depression is a relatively common mental illness, and I think that there is a lot of benefit that can come from studying it. And I'd had some background in analyzing social media. So putting all those things together, it seemed like a promising first place to start applying some of these techniques. There had been some work done with other forms of social media before, looking at trying to predict depression on Twitter and Facebook, but they'd all used some form of text analysis. You know, tweets are generally a bunch of words, as are many Facebook posts. So things like looking at the parts of speech that are used and the emotion behind the words that are posted, all those things are pretty well known, and so it was easy to analyze. Nobody yet had done anything looking at photographs, like Instagram, where people post mostly photos. And I think that's interesting because for humans, you know, we say that a picture is worth 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. To a computer, it's very non-obvious exactly what all that information is. And so I thought it was a good challenge to try and figure out if we could pull out some psychologically important signals from the photographs that people are posting.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what researchers can learn about one's mental health from the photo sharing app Instagram. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's different, too, because when you're putting something into text, you're thinking about what it's actually saying, whereas when you're just sharing an image, people aren't necessarily as super conscious of what that might be saying about themselves.
I think that's an interesting point. My personal take is that anytime someone chooses to share something on social media, they're trying to express something. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right that oftentimes images are harder to craft in terms of that meaning. But it still means something, which is the central tenet of the research that we did, is that getting at that something may tell us something about people's internal mental states, and it may be able to find ways to help people who are suffering.
Right. I was thinking of, like, you know, the people on Facebook who write, sigh. I'm wondering, okay, what's wrong now? Whereas a photo, they may not be as conscious of it. So in some ways, it seems like it could tell you something more authentic about what's going on. Tell us about the connections between color and emotions.
So there's a long literature in clinical psychology, and I should step back for a second and say I'm a social psychologist. So clinical psychology is something that I have a relationship with, but I'm certainly no expert. So I actually had to do a lot of digging myself for this project. And I found that perhaps unsurprisingly, there's a lot of literature associating different mood disorders with preferences for different types of color. It's maybe glossing over some of the finer details, but in general, depressed people seem to have a preference for darker and grayer colors, and also colors shifted more towards the cool, bluer, purple side of the color spectrum, and healthier people tend to prefer brighter, more vivid tones. So we took that that idea and converted that into something that a computer could understand. So remember, for a machine, it doesn't see a photograph; it just sees a series of pixels. So I had it take every photo, and it looked pixel by pixel, and it checked to see where on the color spectrum that pixel was, and also how bright it was and how vivid it was. Hmm. Then it took an average for every photo over however many millions of pixels are in a photo, and then it had information about color and brightness and so on for everyone's photos who contributed to the study. The interesting finding that we came out with is that depressed people tend to post photos that are bluer, darker, and grayer or less vivid than healthy people.
And so a healthy person, can you give us a description of what would be typical for them?
In the color sense, just the opposite. You know, the photos tend to be, I mean, this is all in relative to each other.
Sure.
So healthier people were posting brighter, more vivid colors, and also shifted a little bit farther away from the blue and dark blue end of the spectrum, so more warm colors.
What were the markers you looked for depression in photos? You mentioned how many faces were shown in the photos.
Yes.
Is that like a marker?
Yeah, I'd say there were about four main categories of markers that we looked at. The color, brightness, that whole category I would just put in color. So that's one set of markers. We also used a face detection algorithm to count how many human faces were in a photo. So we looked at, first of all, is there a face at all? And if so, how many are there? A third category was the metadata, you might say, that's associated with a post, especially community feedback. So how many likes did a photo get? And how many comments did it get? And then finally, we looked at, Instagram has these filters that it allows its users to apply to their photographs that change the look of a photo. So it can make it, look like an old sepia-toned photo or very bright and new and so forth. So we looked to see whether people were using filters also. So those four categories, filters, faces, community reaction, and color, those are kind of the broad categories we looked at as predictors.
Which Instagram filter did you see a pattern there as well when it came to people who are depressed?
So the most surprising finding we found there is that depressed people by far prefer not to use any filters at all compared to healthy people. And we're still wondering, why that might be the case. However, when people did use filters, we also saw a stark difference. Depressed people, compared to healthy people, tended to use the inkwell filter, which takes all the color out of a photo, turns it into black and white. And by comparison, healthy people, compared to depressed people, tended to use a photo filter called Valencia, which makes photos warmer and brighter. So you can see that there's some intuitive relationship, I suppose, there to common perceptions of how depression might influence people's perception.
You created an algorithm to analyze photos and predict depression. How did that work? I guess how accurate was it, was what I mean to say.
Oh, got you. Well, there are a couple of different ways to talk about accuracy. So I guess in big picture, the two things that we really care about are how many depressed people who are actually depressed does the algorithm find? But another important thing is, out of all of the labels of depression that an algorithm makes, how many of those are correct? You could see how those are two different things. I could find almost none of the depressed people, but when I do declare you're depressed, I'm right.
Okay.
And vice versa. So those two things are important. I should mention that we did two different diagnoses, and then I'll jump into the accuracy point, because the accuracy is different. I said two different diagnoses. We did two different analyses.
Okay.
The first analysis was just to answer the basic question: do depressed people look different than non-depressed people on Instagram? Mm-hmm. And so, in that case, we just took all of the posts that the depressed people had and all of the posts that the healthy participants had in our study, and we compared the two. We found out that they do look different. And so in that case, we were able to find about 70% of all of the depressed cases in our data. So that's often called recall. And then out of the depressed labels that the algorithm made, it was right about 6 out of 10 times. So that's just looking at all of the data. And again, I wouldn't say that's a home run, but that's not bad for a computer just trying to figure out how people feel.
Mm-hmm.
There's a second and what I think is a more interesting analysis that we did after that. So we answered the first question, yes, these two groups look different. Second question, I think, has more clinical interest, which is to say, well, you know, after somebody receives a diagnosis of depression, there's some literature that says they may come to identify with their diagnosis. They may start to think of themselves as depressed. That could very easily color the way that they interact and communicate on social media. So maybe it's not that interesting to see that people who already know they're depressed are posting different photos. So more interesting would be to say, let's look at only the posts that people make before they were ever diagnosed with depression for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And now compare that against healthy controls. When we did that, we still found a difference. The numbers weren't quite as strong, but we still had significant predictive accuracy that said even before somebody's diagnosed with depression for the very first time, our algorithm can pick out that there's some depression happening there.
Yeah, because the whole idea of self-awareness is kind of like you're not a fly on the wall anymore. They're aware of what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it changes.
To be fair, it's not. I think that many people might suspect that they're depressed before they receive a diagnosis. So we're certainly not ruling out that there's some maybe suspicion that's influencing the way that they communicate online. But from a clinical perspective, it's very, I think, it's much more informative to know that these signals are showing up in social media before a clinician actually makes that first diagnosis.
How are you imagining, if we extrapolate for a moment, about how the knowledge of this all could be used in a practical way?
So I think that there's an important caveat to make, and then I'll answer that question.
Sure.
The caveat here is we have a pretty specific group of people who participated in this study, and there's a lot more research that needs to be done before we know that our findings can really extend to a broader population. So just think about the people who were willing to participate in our study. First of all, we did these analyses online. We had surveys online that people filled out. So that right there, that you have to find people who are online and willing to fill out surveys.
Right.
On top of that, they have to have a history of depression, which very fortunately is not the majority of people. On top of that, they had to be using social media at the time of their depression. And then this is the big step. They've got to be willing to share not only their personal private health history with researchers that they don't know, but they've also got to be willing to share all of their social media history. I mean, this is a pretty special group of people, in my opinion. And that means that there's two things. One, we don't know whether this group of people uses social media differently than, say, other people. But we also don't know whether they exhibit the same types of depressive symptoms as other people. So we have to be really careful about taking the findings that we have right here and saying that they just apply to everybody. That's
gotcha.
Definitely not the case. Having said that, you know, let's speculate for a moment and say that that future research kind of broadens and extends our confidence in these findings to the point where we say, yeah, there's really something going on here for just about anybody who has depression. I think that a very uncontroversial way of applying this would be to offer some kind of personal app where people, it doesn't go to healthcare providers or anyone at all. It's just something that you can sign up for. You have a little online monitor, and maybe they send you an email if they notice that over the past few weeks, the tone of your social media correspondence has started going a little blue. That's just kind of like a personal check-in, I think. In a way that might actually help healthcare at large, I could see something like an opt-in program where people volunteer to share their social media information with their healthcare providers, and then physicians might have a little, a tablet when they're doing their diagnostic interviews, and they have lots of different sorts of monitoring information up on the tablet. Maybe just one of those pieces is saying, hey, the social media profile of this person you might want to ask a few extra questions here to see if they need some help that they're not getting. But again, all that is, I think, really far down the line. We do hope that at some point this work can be a proof of concept that ends up helping people.
Well, thanks for talking about it with us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Rees is a graduate researcher in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. We'll have a link to the paper he was the lead author on regarding the link between what we post on Instagram and the connection to our mental health. Something way in the future, perhaps, but it's interesting to talk about now. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. There are currently more monthly users on Facebook in the United States than there are registered voters. The social media website has become a platform for discussing presidential candidates, usually focusing on the most divisive aspects of their campaigns. Behind all those links and memes, however, is a real business model based on shares and views. And the distributors of partisan clickbait, they're having a large impact on the overall discourse of the election. Joining us now is New York Times reporter John Herman, who recently wrote about this for the New York Times Magazine. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. John Herman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you start off by explaining how Facebook's news feed works and how items end up in it?
Sure. At the most basic level, the news feed is sort of intended to show you media, whether it's an update from a friend, an image, a video, an article that Facebook believes you want to see. And that could be based on the people you're friends with, the pages you've liked or looked at. It's also based on a lot of subtler behaviors, things that you've implicitly sort of expressed interest in, types of articles or videos that you've lingered on for a particularly long time. Facebook sort of sees as its primary mission to show you things that you're interested in. And so you end up with a sort of vast set of sources compressed into one single feed that you might check quite a few times a day.
I told you before we went on the air that I hadn't thought about it before, but I'm definitely noticing it this time. It's ramped up this time versus even 4 years ago.
Certainly. And a big part of that is just that Facebook and services like it have become a much more central part of our lives. I can't remember the exact stat, but there was a study, I think, earlier this year suggesting that the average Facebook user spends nearly 50 or 55 minutes per day on the service. And you can't really take up that much time or take over that much of the general discourse and of communication between people without inheriting a real chunk of the political conversation.
Right. Point being, if you spend 55 minutes a day reading the newspaper, which more people should do, you'd be getting a whole different kind of a sense about what's going on out there than if you spend most of your time going through Facebook.
Right. I mean, it's and also this season, the politics is kind of unavoidable. We've got an unusual election with some, historically controversial candidates. It's hard to go to a restaurant and not end up overhearing a conversation about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. So imagine a giant network of hundreds of your friends and acquaintances and coworkers. It's inevitable that you will end up on politics.
Talk about some of the entities that are harnessing the power of Facebook most effectively this election cycle. They tend to be a radical right or left, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook, in the few months I've spent sort of studying this, it really provides a great place for people to register complaints or to sort of express anger or outrage or, to communicate some sense of injustice. And what that means is that you end up as a content provider, as a publisher, or as a sort of Facebook page operator. You get a lot of indications that people want to be angry. They want to be they want to share their discontent with how things are, and that's resulted in, I think, kind of a new class of publisher that exists more or less only on Facebook. You know, you log into your newsfeed and you see news organizations that you might recognize from the outside world. You see politicians posting things. You see advocacy groups, and then you see all kinds of other things mixed in. But you might see pages that are publishing image macros and memes and getting tens of thousands of shares. You might see sort of descriptively titled pages with names like Right Alerts or, you know, Make America Great Again, or names that sort of say a lot about what the pages are going to stand for. And entities like that, cumulatively, they've got tens of millions of followers. They're reaching more people than that. And they've become a real part of the Facebook political conversation.
Right. This new class of publisher, the magic is in the shares, right?
Right. They're an interesting species, because if you're a major media company on Facebook, you want to reach people. You want to share your news or whatever it is that you create. But you also want to support the organization outside of Facebook. You want to bring readers back to your website, or you want to convert them into subscribers or something like that. And these publications are lean and small. They're often run by one or two people. They do need to make money to survive, but they don't need to make that much. And they really have, and this is a strange way to put it, I guess, but they kind of have the luxury of being able to exist solely on Facebook, to exist on Facebook's terms, to just get as many shares as possible, to get as many followers as possible, and not to worry about all these big external factors that other sorts of media organizations would have to worry about.
Right. They just don't have the overhead, right? But are they generating profit?
They are. I talked to more than a dozen page operators. Some of them have sort of one or two person operations that you know, they'll convert a few hundred thousand followers or maybe a million followers into $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month in revenue just by sending people to an external site covered with ads. It's a simple business model, and it's not unlike what most media companies do on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I mean, any newspaper, for example, is ultimately trying to show their readers ads, and that's kind of their relationship with Facebook too. But yeah, for an operation run very cheaply, that's pretty good money. I talked to some other people who've sort of turned this into a larger business. There's a company called the Liberty Alliance that has, I think, somewhere up north of 150 separate Facebook pages connected to maybe 70 or 75 separate websites, and some of these are sort of interchangeable right-leaning news pages that have developed following. Some of them are run by kind of movement celebrities, people like Alan West or Joe the Plumber. And they've turned this into a real business. I think they're on track this year to make about $12 million in revenue. And, you know, the election season has been good for them. And it's a minimalist business model, but it's working.
Yeah, you wrote that many of these political news pages will lose steam after the election, but one exception you cited was Liberty Alliance. What makes them different?
Well, they're just sort of bigger than everyone else. It's hard once you know that how many pages they operate. It's kind of incredible to look at the reach they have. You really do encounter them in your news feed, in the trending topics, just sort of around the internet in general. But they, you know, what they would be able to do with a network like that and with so many personalities is to sort of pivot after the election, to sort of strategize on a higher level. If you're running one page and your page is explicitly supporting Donald Trump and you're posting dozens of sort of aggregated news stories to it, it's going to be hard to sustain the level of attention that you're getting now. And that level of attention is incredibly high. A number of the people I talk to in this space, they come from an internet marketing background, not a political background. Yeah. They saw in Donald Trump an exceptionally I guess you'd say, viral phenomenon, and the kind of character who could really sort of change the math on your internet advertising business. And that sounds a little cynical going in, but it's worth noting that almost everyone I talk to who took that approach eventually sort of came around and became a little more political and sort of began to think of themselves as part of this movement.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with New York Times reporter John Herman about the growth of the new class of publisher on Facebook in this political season, particularly, has been ripe for the picking. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is the political echo chamber that's created by this new class of publisher worse than ever as a result of these popular partisan Facebook pages, I guess, in this particular election cycle? I've noticed a lot of people, I don't know about you, but saying, you know, I'm going to sign off from Facebook for a while until after the election. Have you noticed that?
I mean, it's really hard to make any comparisons like that. I know Mark Zuckerberg himself on a recent earnings call sort of suggested that people's previous media habits before social media also composed bubbles in a way. But I mean, that's not exactly a rigorous argument, and I don't have a rigorous counter argument. What I can say is that certainly your awareness of your bubble is kind of heightened on Facebook. It's sort of a platform for creating bubbles, and so you're really always aware of it. And then also it's a platform for conversation and communication. And so not only are you in a bubble in the same way you might be if you only read one publication or watched one TV channel, you're talking with people about it. So you're reckoning you're either living your sort of partisan lifestyle in a fuller way, commenting, sharing, arguing with people, or you're fighting it in a more sort of intense way by, you know, getting in sort of knockdown, drag out arguments with friends or family, or maybe with coworkers or acquaintances or former classmates who you never would have ended up in a political conversation with. So it certainly feels like it's intensified. But, you know, again, it's hard to draw broad conclusions from that, because that is also kind of the election season that we're in right now.
Does the fact that some of these pages have a larger following than established news sources such as CNN or the New York Times, does that signify something about the future of media? I mean, is this going to be a new rut in the road?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these pages will often reach as many people in a given month as news organizations with dozens of employees, hundreds of employees, and they'll do so at a really low cost. And if you are in the media, it's impossible to look at that and not think that something has to sort of change. And this is a broader media-wide change that I think most companies have tried to deal with, and that a lot of startups have sort of appeared to answer. But unlike all those media companies and all those startups, these pages they sort of have this narrow kind of freedom to be pure creatures of Facebook. They only need to make as much money as their small staffs need for support, and then they can just sort of do everything else on Facebook's terms. And ultimately what you end up with is a set of extremely influential pages they tend to be extremely partisan. I talked to one entrepreneur who was trying to start Facebook pages that sort of ran down the middle, as he thought of them, pages that I believe one of them was called Opposing Views. And he openly admitted, like, it's just harder on Facebook to do that kind of news, to sort of purport to be the centrist news organization. What people really want when they're sharing something that is connected to their identity, when they're sharing something under their name among people that they know in real life, they want something that sort of expresses what they believe or what they don't believe. And a conventional sort of headline, a sort of ostensibly balanced report on something, it's not the most efficient way to get that point across. You know, you have to explain that story. You have to explain what you think it means. A lot of these pages will provide you with an image, a video, or a story that just says it for you. Here's what I believe. Here's who I think is wrong. Here's who I think is stupid. Here's who I think is a genius. I mean, it gets more intense from there.
Yeah. And it does it tend to be more left-leaning or more right-leaning?
That is something that only Facebook knows, and something that I'm not it's not clear how actively they're studying it. They did give us a few very broad statistics suggesting that there were more posts in general, or rather there was a higher level of engagement in general around Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, but they couldn't tell us or wouldn't tell us if that engagement was primarily positive or primarily negative. They couldn't tell us if the engagement around Hillary Clinton, for example, was coming from Trump supporters saying negative things, or if it was primarily coming from her supporters, as positive posts and positive shares. So it's really hard to tell. And it was very telling for me in the reporting process to talk to people on both sides of this. People on left-leaning Facebook say, Donald Trump doesn't have a chance. They're in a bubble. We're not. We're speaking for people. the anti-Trump content does so well that we're sure things are going great. Meanwhile, on right-leaning Facebook pages, the narrative is more like, here is a great sort of untapped population. One word I heard a lot was, these are instinctive conservatives who are being activated on Facebook. And so there's this sense there, because of the intensity of the interaction, the level of sharing, the enthusiasm with which people are engaging with these pages, that Facebook is sort of a clue that maybe Donald Trump is doing better than people think. But both sides think they're winning the Facebook war.
And by the way, they're not necessarily creating content. They're just sort of rejiggering it, creating compendiums, that kind of a thing, to make a point.
Right. It's kind of a spectrum. Some of the pages actively create original image memes, and they're really good at it. Other pages do pure aggregation. And within the Facebook ecosystem, it's often hard to tell where things come from. That's true in general on the web as well, but because of the way shares just appear in your feed without context, with very little connection to the page that they originated from, it's pretty easy to pass off someone else's post as your own, or to just sort of quickly re-summarize it, and to get a lot of engagement from that. And honestly, as far as I can tell, most people following these pages aren't too hung up on content sourcing or proper credit. It's, again, more about getting a point across in a way that's really powerful, that's maybe a little more potent than what you would have come up with yourself. And then there are a lot of these pages in the sort of middle, and I would at least dozens of pages like this, that they might have a logo that just says something like breaking news. And they might have a generic name along the lines of, conservative updates or something like that, just to make one up. And that's enough of a signal for people to say, okay, this page is sharing news. It's probably aligned with me. I'm fine sharing it because the headline sounds right to me. And this speaks to my followers. This speaks to my friends in the voice that I want to speak in.
Interesting. John Herman, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
John Herman, writer for The New York Times, talking about how Facebook's news feeds work in our latest era of politics. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Facebook acquired the popular messaging service WhatsApp in 2014. Not much changed until recently, when its terms and conditions were amended to permit data sharing with the parent company. Many users are not pleased. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
First off, for those who aren't familiar with WhatsApp, spelled WHATSAPP, how is it different from just text messaging?
Well, so this is a global messaging app. It's something that's used all over the world, and one of its biggest features is the ability to inexpensively send text messages to groups or to you know, individuals who are all over the world, regardless of where they live. And the same goes for kind of basic over Wi-Fi phone calls and things like that. It's a really fantastic group messaging app that will, in many ways, replace text messaging for people who use it.
I used it when I was traveling with a group overseas a few years ago, and it was very helpful.
Yeah, its greatest feature is that anyone can use it, and it replaces the usual costs associated to text messaging when abroad.
So with these new changes, what data is going to be shared with Facebook? What's going on here?
So Facebook's big claim here is that they are trying to take the WhatsApp information and use it for more targeted advertising for those users. And it starts with things like your phone number, and it could certainly increase over time to messaging patterns or images that you've shared or things like that, anything that would, you know, kind of pull in and make it easier for Facebook to serve you ads. But it's starting with your phone number, and it'll take your phone number and attach it to your Facebook account. And that's something a lot of people are really uncomfortable with, especially people who are using WhatsApp as kind of like a second phone number, something that would be used for maybe more private conversations, for example.
Oh, I see. Okay, so will this mean that, all right, have WhatsApp users been already seeing ads in the app or what?
Not in the app. This will take it to basically for their Facebook profile.
Okay.
It would basically be more targeted for their Facebook profile. But the big thing here is over the next 30 days, they've made the announcement, and over the next 30 days, anyone who is currently using WhatsApp can go into the settings and turn the feature off where they're not sharing information with Facebook.
And what's your sense about what you're hearing about how many people are going to do that?
So many people are doing it. We we wrote a brief tutorial for how to do it for both the iPhone and for Android, and you know, tens of thousands of people immediately thanked us for showing, you know, how it was done. It's very simple. You go into your settings and there's a big button for sharing your information with your account, and you can go through and turn off that information. But it's important, if you are already using WhatsApp, to make the decision now, because it's only that button's only going to be around for 30 days.
Really?
It's something that Facebook is giving. They updated their terms of service, and they said for the next 30 days you can make this decision, and then after the 30 days it's going to be a mandatory part of their terms of service.
Interesting. Okay. You know, last week we ran out of time before we could talk about the Chinese smartphone maker Huawei's latest device, the Honor 8. We talked about it a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about Huawei. When did they start selling phones in the U.S.?
Very, very recently.
Yeah.
This is the first phone that's being sold in the same way that you would see more traditional phones being sold, like, you know, Google's Nexus line, where it's just something you can buy very quickly and have shipped to you overnight. It's not something that you're going to see in carrier stores. This is an unlocked phone, and what that means is you can add a SIM from your carrier to the phone, and it'll work very much like a phone that you've bought from AT&T or T-Mobile or Verizon. But it's not something you're going to be buying from those stores. But one of the benefits of the way Huawei is doing this is the cost of the phone. This is a very powerful, very capable phone that's $400, which is, in several cases, half the cost of what you would spend for an equivalent iPhone, 6S Plus or Samsung Galaxy Note 7, for example, are both, $750 and then sometimes more.
And what mobile phone carriers are going to be available on this?
This is going to work with AT&T and T-Mobile. Okay. Out of the box, where you can just take, if you're an existing AT&T or T-Mobile customer, you can just put your SIM card in and it'll start working immediately.
Okay. The smartphone market is so competitive. There are so many options. I'm constantly confused. What is Huawei doing to set it apart? The price for what you get for it?
The price is a huge part of what they're doing. They also have a really interesting support structure for customers who buy the phone and then they have help. Huawei has really engaged customer service group that will work with people through the phone that they're using in order to try and get things fixed when there's something with the phone. And that's something that you really just don't get a whole lot of here in the U.S. right now, because it's very expensive to maintain. And Huawei is able to do this for a couple of reasons, the first being that it's largely fan-driven. They have a ton of people who are just big fans of the brand who kind of offer help, almost like a community forum. that are able to help out.
In the U.S.?
It's a global setup, you know. So
okay.
Huawei has been selling. They're a very popular brand in China right now, and they've been trying very hard to bring the phones over here to the U.S. There were some regulatory issues over the last couple of years for the kind of hardware they were using and the chips that they were using, and they've resolved that by working with manufacturers that are more U.S. friendly. But the big thing, I think, is not really using the Huawei brand here in the U.S. One, because it's kind of hard to say. Especially when you look at how it is spelled. But you're going to see these phones here in the U.S. Just under the brand Honor. So it'll be, the Honor 8 is
okay.
What you see when you go to buy the phone. It's not even going to have the Huawei brand attached to it. And that's a significant push for them, is kind of treating Honor almost like it's its own company in selling these phones in the U.S. because Huawei has a large, company business. They do a lot of different things, including networking equipment. And there have been some regulatory issues in the past where the U.S. government has suggested not using Huawei networking equipment because there could be programming backdoors for Chinese hackers and things like that. And so, in an attempt to kind of step aside from those problems, they're releasing the phone in the U.S. as that Honor brand.
Interesting name. It's pretty popular in China, then?
Very popular in China. The phones are easily as popular as an iPhone when it's sold over there. And it's one of the reasons that the iPhone has not been overly successful in China because of brands like Honor that are able to sell for just significantly less and offer comparable features.
One of which is the camera. It's very good.
This is a unique camera. It actually has two sensors on the back that are doing two very different things at the exact same time to take a single image. There's one sensor that does things in black and white, kind of monochrome. And there's another sensor that does a full color sensor. And the black and white kind of works to take a really great photo in terms of white balance. So, not something where you take a lot of pictures with your phone and kind of the sky looks all washed out because the sun is directly, in the shot. And it makes it really hard to take that picture. This combination of sensors actually makes it a whole lot easier to take those kind of pictures where the sky looks a lot more full. It looks a lot less washed out. And it's a really kind of unique way to do this. And I think it's something we're going to see a lot more of over the next year or two.
So, and what else? What else sets it apart? I mean, anything? Who would you recommend for this?
This is someone who is, familiar enough with a smartphone to not feel the need to walk into a store to make a purchase and understands, that the contract plan is not, usually the most financially viable way to have a phone if you're going to be replacing it every 2 years. For $400, you have to kind of have the mindset that you're going to spend that money. And a lot of people are still under the impression that you walk into a store and you spend $200 on a phone and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of knowing that you spend that $200 on the phone, but then you also spend a certain amount every month to continue paying that phone off.
Right.
And so anyone who is kind of already aware of how that works, this is a perfect option for them.
Okay. We're going to talk about how Hewlett-Packard has a new privacy option for its laptop customers. Tell us about SureView.
This is really fascinating stuff. A lot of laptops have third-party, privacy screens where you can buy them. They're kind of this flimsy piece of plastic that you put in front of your screen, and anyone looking at your screen from like a 45-degree angle, they can't really see what's happening on the screen. It's mm-hmm. kind of a safety thing to keep people from reading what's happening on your screen when you're at a coffee shop or something.
Okay.
But it's kind of a tacky plastic thing that lays on top. HP has started building them directly into the laptop and has it so that instead of having it on all the time, you can actually activate it and deactivate it with a key press on the laptop. So you press, like Alt F4, or something. I can't remember what the key press was. And the screen, if you're looking at it from an angle, the screen looks like it almost turned off completely, as though there were a privacy screen being laid over top of it. And it's actually built into the display, and it can be activated and deactivated whenever you feel it's necessary, which was really interesting.
Yeah, so if it's built in and all of that, it's using up more power, though, right?
It's not going to be using a whole lot more power.
Okay.
This is really just it's almost like a filter being applied.
And why would you not have it on all the time? Why even the activation issue?
You certainly can have it on all the time. You can choose to have it on by default when you start the laptop up. But this is something if you're sharing something with a group of people and you have people kind of crowded around your desk to look at a thing, then, it becomes less convenient.
Right, right, right. And is it adding significantly to the cost?
It's not going to add significantly to the cost. You know, the HP laptop series, I think this one starts at $750 for their lower-end model. And this is anything they'll be labeled going into the holiday season where they'll have the SureView sticker on them to let you know that they have that feature built in.
Hmm. It's interesting what they're always coming up with, right? It's these little things at this point. It feels like everything's getting pretty fine-tuned.
Absolutely. This seemed like something, you know, because I know tons of people who the first thing they do when they buy a new laptop is they buy a privacy screen that you know, works with it, that doesn't, you know, feel like it's hanging off of it. It feels like it's kind of a part of the screen.
Uh-huh.
And so having something built in really just kind of seems like an obvious thing.
Yeah, exactly. You recently reviewed an updated version of the 360-degree camera, the 360 Fly. Tell us about it. What's the deal with this camera?
I really like the idea of a 360 Fly camera. Instead of, you know, being this kind of awkward-looking stick that you push a button on and it takes a 360-degree photo, which is what we see for a lot of these cameras, this is almost like a GoPro that captures in 360 degrees. It's this small orb that you mount somewhere, and you know, then you hit record and you go and do the thing that you're going to do. And they're designed to be pretty impact-resistant and water-resistant down to a full atmosphere, and can really just kind of record everything that was going on around you. And the problem with the previous version of this camera was really that it didn't take pictures very well, and the sensor just wasn't very high resolution. So the videos and pictures that you got just really were not very high quality. And the 4K version of this camera resolves that issue and adds a few more features.
Like what?
The first is the live streaming feature, which I really didn't think I was going to use because, you know, I didn't feel the need to share exactly what I was happening when it was happening. But there's a function now where you can use an app called Livit, L-I-V-I-T, to view a 360-degree live stream of what's happening from this camera. So it can be mounted anywhere, you know, at a concert, for example, and someone can take a look through this app, and as they move their phone around, you know, see more of the 360-degree you know, world around the camera, so you can kind of, you know, look as though you were there.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, and it can capture stereo audio as well.
Yes, it has several microphones in it and a special audio system for capturing 360-degree sound. It's still a little, what's the best way to say it? It's still a little sensitive to really loud noise.
Okay.
One of the first things that I like to do with these kind of 360-degree cameras is strap them to a side of a motorcycle.
Okay.
it turns out that, you know, there is no, you know, small microphone that can filter that much noise out. Those things are just too loud.
And is once the video's been recorded, what's the best way to look at it?
You can look at it through Facebook. You can look at it through YouTube. Flickr has a service that will allow you to see it. There are a lot of options now for looking at 360-degree photos. I am regularly posting 360-degree photos and videos to my personal Facebook page, and it's a lot of fun to watch people kind of take a look through their phone and see it all.
Yeah, yeah. And, again, this isn't 3D. This is 360-degree. But does it feel sort of like that?
You can take photos that make them feel that way, and if you're using kind of a virtual reality headset or something like Google Cardboard, then you can look and kind of get that perspective. But they're designed to work on two-dimensional screens most of the time. So your normal monitors and phones will give you a really neat, you know, kind of bubble effect that you can look through.
Are they expensive?
They start at $400, so they are not cheap when it comes to, you know, a camera that is a single purpose, but they're also very similarly priced to what you would get from like a GoPro camera that you would buy specifically for recording things kind of in abstract.
Right. Why buy GoPro when you could do this?
Right.
Because this could do both, right? It doesn't have to be 360 degree.
It doesn't have to be 360 degree. There's a point of view mode that you can use for it, but the 360, I think, is probably the coolest feature to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, Russell Holley, once again, thanks a lot. Always appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.